Welcome to Paper Money, the bi-weekly podcast covering the business side of the game industry, from Thunderstone to Trouble, from AEG to Milton Bradley. I'm Ben Clark.
And I'm Rhett Kipp.
Today is April 13th, 2011. Rhett, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, yeah. Hey, you know, it's been one of those weeks.
Yeah. For finally, the show is getting posted late, and it's not my fault. I'm so excited.
Yes, it's true.
You must be getting old, Red. It took you, 2 days to recover from Little Wars?
It didn't really take me 2 days. It took me much time to take care of business as opposed to be able to gallivant around.
I don't even want to know. Oh, it wasn't a euphemism.
It wasn't a euphemism.
Gotcha.
My business will be on display at Origins.
Okay. Again, I pray to God it's not a euphemism, but all right.
There we go.
So we'll find out. We'll do that when we're pimping Origins later in
That's right.
Later in the month. So anyways, our show preview this week, corrections. None.
That's two in a row.
We're back on track. Now, if we could just get the show out on time. News, yes, we do actually have news. Guest, no, we don't have a guest this week. And for commentary, I'll be talking about the very exciting subject of printing cards.
That's a very useful subject. I had a number of people ask about it just this weekend.
Well, I'm the guy to talk to about that. So we're going to talk a little bit about it, about the mechanics of it and about what you need to look for and what not to pay for and what to pay for when you go and get your cards printed. And certainly as a game player, it's just nice to be, you know, amaze people with your goofy knowledge. But anyways, with that, without further ado, let's move into the news. And congratulations to the Purple Pawn this week. They've had their 1,000,000th visitor to the site. I know that's kind of an arbitrary landmark, but by the same token, that's really awesome.
That is cool. That's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it's not like it means anything in the web world in particular. On the other hand, I don't think I've had the 1,000th visitor to any of the sites that I've built over the course of my career. So 1,000,000 visits, it really is kind of cool. And they are, by the way, giving away a game as a result of that. So go over to the Purple Pawn, win a game, and be their 1,007,000th visitor or similar. So anyways, congrats to the Purple Pawn. And I'm not just saying that because they host the website, but it really is a good news site.
Yeah, that's a really cool thing. I'm glad that, you know, they're showing that success.
Yes, exactly. So I'm glad they're not giving away a game for their 1,000th visitor. So,
but I might not be so objectionable to that if I knew I could come in around 1,000 every time.
You know, anyway. as an employee or a relative of an employee or whatever, I think you're ineligible. But not that we get paid, but you're still ineligible.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
So don't want the contest to look right. Anyway, so congrats to the Purple Pawn. And moving on, it just wouldn't be springtime in the game industry if we didn't have an announcement about another dumb Hasbro movie being made.
It's not Battleship?
I'm sorry, dumb is pejorative, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, anyway, suffice to say, they've inked a deal on a Candyland movie. At least Candyland has some semblance of a plot to the game, as opposed to Battleship. But they're doing a Candyland movie, and it's going to be penned by the Kung Fu Panda writers. I'll be blunt, I haven't seen Kung Fu Panda. They're doing a sequel. I'll be honest, I got to a point where I was jack blacked out. If you'll pardon the coinage of the term, and so I didn't take my kids to see it. So, but suffice to say, it didn't suck horribly. It wasn't Planet 51 in terms of the animation scale. So,
it was decently written.
Gotcha. So suffice to say, Candyland movie. My guess is look for this in 2012. So I don't think they're going to do another big budget Hasbro movie after Battleship. So I think it's coming out next year. Moving on. Cue the music.
Toys R Us.
Toys R Us is paying a $1.3 million fine. This story comes courtesy of Playthings.com. They're paying a civil penalty to settle the Federal Trade Commission charges it violated its 1998 order, which prohibited it from urging suppliers to limit supply of products to discounters. So apparently they were in trouble for this in 1998, and then again, they've done this again. Now, this is important to note. This was their Babies R Us subsidiary. They complained to their suppliers about discounts other retailers were providing to consumers and attempted to limit who they sold to based on their size. Now, this doesn't affect the game market, but folks, if you're in the mass market, welcome to the world. This is kind of how things go. But they were, in fact, told to stop doing that. But I it's $1.3 million, which compared to the debt that Toys R Us has, really no big deal.
Oh yeah. I was going to say at this amount of money, it's a penalty, not much.
Well, you know, what's interesting though, what's interesting to me as someone in the game industry, is seeing this complaint against, Toys R Us for complaining about discounters is that all of the hobby stores complain that they can't sell it once Toys R Us gets it.
Right.
So here we have what would be considered by game industry standards as being a discounter, complaining about discounters.
Right.
So I guess the shoe was on the other foot. But interesting to note, money does make the world go round. And just for the record, if you're selling into Toys R Us and they try and limit who you're selling to, you're going to have to seriously think about playing ball if you're in a game industry. But again, this was their Babies R Us side. So
yeah,
I'm sure everyone on the game side is completely above board. That said, I think we have one other story here. Nope, that was it. That was a short news week.
It was a very short news week, yeah.
So, Rhett, very briefly, I guess, tell us about Little Wars.
Well, Little Wars, for those who aren't aware, is HMGS Midwest's premier show. They're looking at a second show kind of semi-regularly in the fall, but this is really their big show. Anyway, they moved this year for the first time in about a decade. They're out in St. Charles, a new location, much nicer location.
Now, for those of you not from the Chicago area, Little Wars was traditionally held on the far north-northwest side of town, and they have now moved to the far southwest side of town.
Southwest. It was on the northeast, and they moved to the southwest side of the town. And, it's from people I know who were just a few minutes from there, it's now about an hour and a half difference.
Yeah, Chicago's a very long metro area. It's very vertical.
About a lake.
Yes, yes. There's no – exactly. Everyone – either you go north, south, or west. There is no east because of the lake. But now, Rhett, you said that affected attendance a little bit when we were talking about this.
It did seem to affect attendance simply because the change of location, I think people just wanted to see how it was going to go. They wanted to see what the venue looked like. I had a number of people who I know normally hosted events didn't attend to run games, but came in to see what it all looked like so they could decide in the future whether it was something that they were going to support. And they all came away very, very pleased. The one thing I kept hearing repeatedly, I've seen a few blogs in support of it, is the quality of terrain. The people who came in and hosted games just did above and beyond a job of terrain this year. There's some incredibly beautiful pieces out there.
Was this like Uncle Duke, epic scale and beyond type of terrain here? Or was this?
Yeah,
this
absolutely. There was a number of Arnhem Bridge games that were put on. There was a Flames of War one, which was an ongoing campaign. There was another one, which was a Germans versus American versus Zombies game. I think it stretched about 24 feet long, and it had toys from end to end, buildings from end to end, roads. For those who aren't familiar with the zombie game at Little Wars, it's absolutely one of the best. Every year they change what it's going to be. The first one started out that they were doing Night of the Living Dead pretty much as a game. The cool part of it that really caught everybody's attention was they had a drive-in theater, and on the screen was Night of the Living Dead, and they were actually broadcasting the movie as the game was being played. And every year they try to outdo themselves. But there was a a number of Napoleonic games there that were done really well. There was a number of American Civil War games that were just beautiful. A lot, something that really surprised me that I haven't seen as much of before, a lot of games played in 54 millimeter. Really cool for a convention, not really practical around your house.
Well, you know, I mean, for a big game, it's cool, but usually you only see 54 millimeter as a skirmish type where you've only got, you know, maybe 10 or 12 miniatures on a side.
Yeah, this was the couple of games there. One was the Alamo, you know, and probably hosted, I would say probably 100 figures defending and probably 400 or 500 figures attacking.
Well, there were only 200 in real life, so you're almost on a one-to-one
scale. It was almost on a one-to-one scale there. The Mexicans did not hit their 4,000, though.
Okay, okay.
There was also a lot of other ones. There was also one of the, by far, one of the most brilliant ones, French and Indian war game. And I'm not really sure how the game played. Frankly, I never got an opportunity to see the game really being played. It was just amazing terrain, waterfalls, rivers, heavy, heavy woods. It must have taken the guy months to construct. It was truly a work of art, more than a game.
Yeah, see, this is like my dream miniature setup, really, because honestly, I loved playing Mordheim just because I got to make a lot of terrain. Forget Warhammer 40K. I loved doing the buildings. I loved crowding up a table for a game of Mordheim.
Well, you know, you might be looking forward then to the new Flames of War. I got to talk to Battlefront, and they kind of gave a little reveal on what their next thing is for Flames of War, which is going to be called Infantry Aces. And that's basically a progression system for their units, a la Mordheim Necromunda type of a game.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
So a couple other cool things we got to see there too for reveals. I got to see the upcoming new mini mechs from Iron Wind. That came as a real shock. They're beautiful. They're about an inch and a half tall. Mm-hmm. And that's,
these are all the probably CAD drawn laser cut type stuff, right? Isn't that the new thing for?
Why, I would say it was probably the case for anybody but Iron Wind. Iron Wind, I'm sure, sculpts these. I don't have a document here telling me who did it, but I'm kind of guessing Jeff Wilhelm probably had his hand in on it. You know, he's done tons and tons of the mechs before.
Yeah.
They look just like the full-size mechs, you know, for what they had. They're going to be releasing about a dozen of them in a couple of weeks.
That's awesome. As everyone knows, I'm a big BattleTech fan, and have always enjoyed the sculpts from Iron Wind. But which kind of leads me to go on here from being a BattleTech fan to the following observation. We kind of you hear us, you know, basically dissing Games Workshop a lot during the course of the show for their, you know, many peccadilloes, I guess. But, you know, they make a boatload of money. And the miniature side of the hobby in general isn't regarded as a huge profit center for large companies. But by the same token, there really is a big, strong, vibrant community that does miniature games, that goes into game stores, that buys miniatures off the rack. And Little Wars, I think, is proof of that. I mean, it's still a solid show. It's still very historical.
Well, and one of the things I thought was impressive was that they got a good turnout from their fantasy sci-fi game when Adepticon was just the previous week here in Chicago as well. And
yes,
that was phenomenally attended.
Yes.
I think there was something like 200 or 300 people in the Warhammer tournament alone.
Adepticon is growing. I hesitate to use the word leaps and bounds, but I remember when it started, and it was smallish. You know, it was a local thing, and now it has really grown into one of the premier miniatures events.
It really is.
If not the, well, certainly it's one of the few Games Workshop funded events that's not Games Workshop controlled.
It's the only Games Workshop event that's funded by, or that's sponsored, I should say, by GW in attendance. Forge World was there this year and even announced on their website that they'd done so well that they planned on coming back for sure. And from everything I understand, they sold completely out of their stuff. And I have
You've seen Forge World stuff. Yeah, I can hardly resist buying it online.
So. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say Forge World stuff is beautiful. I don't buy it online because, it's easy to resist online. If I actually held some of that stuff, oh my God, the credit card comes out.
Yeah, and as I said, the amount of money that I heard that they turned on it was phenomenal. So that's really impressive. So that's another show that's growing, and again, proof that miniatures is a growing field, because it used to be just GW stuff that they did there, and now they've expanded it. They now had the Nationals for Flames of War. They had a major tournament for privateers, hordes, and I can't think of the.
It must not matter if you can't remember it right.
Yeah, it's just their,
that's
it's
what
just
we're going to tell our listeners. Game. Yeah.
just a bad day. In any case, what I was equally impressed by from Privateer on that support, they gave away 1,000 starter sets of their miniatures.
Wow.
For the first 1,000 people attending. That's it shows you that Privateer has a lot of faith in that event as well.
Yeah. And certainly not a bad spiff for those of you thinking about attending next year.
No, that's it's a $50 unit that they're handing you for coming through the doors.
Wow. If I'd known. Anyways.
It's War Machine. Yeah. Now you don't have to correct me on the next thing.
War Machine, which, yeah. Anyways, let's move on a little bit here. Let's switch gears from miniatures to playing cards. And I wanted to talk a little bit about, this is one of my areas of expertise. We had Rhett talking a lot about retail the other week. I wanted to talk a little bit about printing, and very specifically printing of playing cards, just because cards are the most complicated thing in any game. Right? If you put custom plastic miniatures in the game, chances are you're going to hand it off to some guy with a picture and say, I want something like this. He deals with it. Somebody else makes a mold. All you have to do is say, yeah, I like that. With cards, there are about a zillion decisions you're going to have to make to get your cards out the door, and you're the one who's going to have to make those decisions. So I want to talk a little bit about it. The first thing you got to consider is, what the hell are you doing with your cards? And Rhett, by the way, feel free to jump in on any of this
I didn't want to interrupt your run.
Yeah, I know. Well, I started out strong, but at some point, if you have a question, completely spontaneous, by the way, Rhett, and I have not rehearsed this at all. In any case, card sizes, all right, the two most common sizes are bridge size and poker size. All right, bridge size is 2.25 by 3.5 inches. Poker size is 2.5 inches by 3.5 inches, or the metric equivalent, okay? Now, poker size is also what you might call Magic the Gathering size, although Magic the Gathering is done in millimeters, which is a guy who printed in the U.S., I think it's 89 by 55 millimeters, something like that. You'd have to get out a caliper. But the point is what matters is how many cards can you get on a printed sheet, on a sheet of paper, all right? The most common large size paper that you can print on is 28 inches by 40 inches. By the time you take a little bit off the edge for bleed and the machine grippers and stuff like that, you can get exactly 100 poker size cards out of a sheet like this.
Why'd they pick that number?
Well, what's funny is that, and we'll go on to talk about a little bit why 110 cards is also very common. But for these large sheets, these 28 by 40 sheets, the 100 size, it just happens you get 10 rows of 10. Okay. I don't know if that happened that way to begin with or not, but it's certainly the way it works out. Certainly it makes you wonder why there was a 54 card poker deck. Long story short, if you have 100 cards on a sheet and you have exactly 100 cards in your game, ta-da, that's easy. Okay. If you have 96 cards in your game, you got to pay somebody at the once those cards are cut, and they're going to have to strip off the last four from the last row of 10. All right. So you're going to have to, it might not add, 10 cents to your cards, but it might add a nickel. And it might add 10 cents. It's going to depend.
Yeah. You've all wondered why there's those blank cards in your deck.
Yeah. Or why you get cards with rules on them, or why you get cards advertising other products. And I guarantee you, if you count the cards, it'll be so that they come out in a multiple of 10. Worst case, it'll be a multiple of five if you flip them. But suffice to say, with poker-sized cards, that's why, because it is so much cheaper and faster to do it without having that person stand at the line. The other reason, by the way, if you have exactly 100 cards is on a sheet, there's a machine called a Roll'em. Okay, actually, it's the Roll'em company. They make a variety of different machines, but it is the only machine in the industry that cuts vertically and horizontally at the same time. So what you can do is you feed it a sheet of 100 cards. It goes zip, 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 cuts it one way, zip, 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 cuts it another, shoots a deck out at the end, and all you got to do is round the corners. You can't do that if you have 96 cards, because you got to pay the guy to take off the four. Well, he can take them off at the deck, but the point is you still got to pay the guy. And if you're doing card collation, okay, which is where you have a machine that's got 20 stations on it, and usually you cut your cards, you have to pre-cut them on a separate machine, into like basically stacks of four, and then it goes through 20 different stations. And when you get done, you basically have a set of four decks that you then recut to get your decks out. Also, very manual labor intensive. Also, does not like in particular prime numbers. Never, ever, ever, ever put cards to the amount of a prime number in your game.
Now, why doesn't it like primes?
Hard to get an even number of rows. Right. If the only factors are 1 and 71, you get it's hard to cut that up into rows of, say, you know, 4x4 or something like that. So card sizes matter. Now, bridge size and 110 cards really common, because what ends up happening is if you print on and I forget the size of this because I didn't have this equipment or we didn't use this card size that often. I think it's, want to say it's a 23x29 sheet. You get exactly 55 cards out. So what you do is you do two sheets of those and you get 110 bridge size cards out. Note that I said 110 bridge size cards out of those two smaller sheets, and that's also very efficient to do. But again, so card size is important. If you go with a weird size that's not poker size or bridge size, talk to your printer, because they're going to tell you the magic number, and you want to get as close to that magic number as possible. The man on the Harley is very excited about that number.
I was going to say, yeah, it certainly seemed like, you know, the entire gang was moving into your neighborhood.
You know, the amusing thing is I looked out the window, a guy rode by on a bicycle. And I thought, was he doing that with his lips? So, anyways. All right. Ben Clark, ADD, easily distracted over here. Anyways, the long story short is there is a magic number for every card size, okay? So if you have 4 inches by 5 inch cards in your game, some oversized cards, so you have like Mad Zeppelin, which has large size cards, find out what the magic number is per sheet for your printer, and it will affect your cost, guaranteed. Now, that said, I wanted to go to types of paper. All right, this is the other big factor you're going to have to look at. Now, Rhett, let me ask you a question. Why are there rounded corners on the edge of cards?
I would guess because it makes them easier to shuffle.
Bing! This is why Trivial Pursuit has square cards, because you never shuffle them, right? So,
absolutely.
So you don't want to have to pay extra for a feature you're not going to use. It looks nice, yes, but it does cost more to have the cards push through a die. Also, this is an important note. If you go with a weird card size, make sure that they have a die for this card, right? A die not being like dice, but a die being a big piece of metal rule that they use a hydraulic press to ram the cards past and nib the corners on. I have those things cost about $2,000. And when I worked at a printer, we had cards shaped like a pirate head.
Awesome.
Yeah, I've never seen the game. I saw the die for it. It's shaped like a pirate head. Somebody paid $2,000 to get that, and I never saw the game, so I assume that it did do well. But this is something you got to consider, right? Is, do I want to pay $2,000 for a die when I'm just starting out? And the answer is usually no. So either go with square cornered cards or go with round cornered cards for an existing die size. Most established companies, by the way, are going to have many, many dies in stock for you to choose from. Don't pay for the round corners if you're not shuffling the cards a lot, is what that comes down to. If you're doing a trivia card game, the other thing to consider is the weight of the paper. All right, there's three common card types here, paper types. And I'm going to do U.S. dimensions, by the way. So those of you printing overseas, I apologize. There really is no direct conversion between points and grams per square meter. One is a measure of thickness, points. One point is a hundredth of an inch, if I recall. And grams per square meter is a measure of density, which inadvertently measures thickness, but it's not quite the same. So, anyways, right? Have we gone like way around the technical bend at this point? Because I got more.
I think, you know, while you're into details, the people who are interested in this are really, you know, this is stuff I don't know anything about, and I'm fascinated.
Okay.
I'm just waiting for you to talk about clay layering, but go ahead.
Which is coming up in a minute. Suffice to say, there's three common thicknesses on cards. There's 10 point, there's 12 point, and then there's, usually it's about a 10.5 or an 11.5 point playing card stock. Now, let me tell you the difference. All right, 10 point is useful in a trivia card game, it's not super thick. All right, if you can't afford playing card stock, because it does cost a lot more, and I'll talk about that in a second, 12-point card stock is a fairly decent compromise. You can still tell it's not playing card stock, but it's thick enough that you can shuffle and play with on a regular basis without ruining the cards. And the third common size is playing card stock. Now, the difference is in paper types, all right? Regular 10-point and 12-point paper are just that, regular paper. Playing card stock is not a paper, it's a laminate, okay? There's two thin sheets of paper, and in between them, there's a sheet of black stuff like carbon paper, and it's all glued together. And the reason for that is, Rhett?
That's so you can't see through the cards.
Bing!
That's also why they put clay in there in the old days.
Well, most of the paper we're talking about here is what's called clay-coated, which basically gives you a much more vibrant color. But the long story short on the playing cards is that because it's a laminate like that, it's springier. In addition to being, I think the registered trademark is Stoplight, by the way. But in terms of that paper, because it's a laminate, because there's glue in there, because it's layered, it's springier. You can hold a playing card, like hold an Uno or a Magic card in between your hands, in between your index finger and your thumb, and squish it. And the one, the playing card will come back to shape much better.
It's called bridging.
Yeah. Then say, like, if you compare that to a Trivial Pursuit card. The reason that this is really good, by the way, is if you do a lot of shuffling, your cards will get out of shape if you're using 10 or 12 point paper, because it's not quite as, it doesn't go back to form as well.
Can you give some samples, or examples, I should say, of, you know, cards that are printed in various forms? I mean, playing cards,
yeah,
that's easy.
Let's say
the other two weights, something that people could relate to.
All right. We've got, give me a couple of examples. Magic the Gathering is, well, it's theoretic. It's a metric card. It's printed on a paper that's sized out at grams per square meters. That is going to be an 11.8 playing card stock. All right. By comparison.
What about like a Monopoly card?
Monopoly cards. See, that's where it gets a little weird. Deed cards are, I think, 18 point. Okay.
Well, but what about the regular cards, though? Like Community Chest and those types.
Those, I think, are 110-pound index, but it's measured differently.
All right, folks, and here it is. I've stumped the expert here.
It's goofy. And if you buy and here's the thing, too. If you buy, like, a game from USAopoly, who prints all of the licensed Monopoly games, they use a different card stock than Monopoly does, than Hasbro. So it's not quite the same. But anyways, an Uno card is also around 11.5, 11.8 point playing card stock. A Trivial Pursuit card, a modern trivia game, is most of them are 10-point card stock. Some of them are going to be printed on the equivalent of 12-point card stock. Both of them, and this is the thing to look for at trivia cards, because this is where you can really save some money if you're doing a big run. Or not a big run, but a game with a lot of cards. Most paper is coated on both sides. Okay? And you get bright, you know, ink colors on both sides of the card. If you're doing a trivia game, a lot of times you just have answers in the back in black, right? So you got color on one side and black on the other, or maybe just a single color. You don't necessarily need that coating on the second side. You can save a boatload of money by getting paper that's coated on one side. It's called C1S. And what that does is basically you end up with flat black instead of a shiny black for that card side. But who cares? It's just the answer. And if it doesn't take anything away from your game, you can save, I'll say 30 plus cents a deck, depending on, you know, how many cards you're printing. 350, 500 cards. It's going to make a fairly substantial difference in price. An uncoated stock or what's called C1S Plus, which is like a slight coating on that one side, but the colors don't pop. It's more of a flat coloring on the uncoated side of the paper. But again, this is complicated stuff. Again, this is why you talk to somebody, who has printed cards before. Any other component in your game, you can talk to somebody who just does printing or just does boxes or whatever. They don't need to know anything game specific. When you are dealing with cards, you need to deal with somebody who has printed cards before, or I guarantee you it will be interesting. And this is one of the reasons.
Well, yeah, those are really good things. Very informative. You know, there's much of that I have no idea about. You know, my expertise really comes down to how do you use them.
Yeah, exactly. And the long story short on this is that you need to, sorry, I just lost my train of thought, is that really, it's a technical thing. And I've always told people when I talk to them on the phone that the learning curve to get your first game printed is very steep, okay? There's a lot of technical stuff you need to know, and cards is one of them. So again, when you're printing cards, it all comes down to the cost of your game. Okay, if you're printing, oh, by the way, we didn't even talk about linen paper, which in the States is fairly ungodly expensive. And the reason for that is that no one makes it. So you have to buy it in massive quantities to get any kind of a decent price on it all. And the same with playing card stock. It's the kind of paper that if you don't buy by the truckload, your paper costs are going to go up anywhere from 35 to 50% just on the paper. So anyways, let's recap here because I'm going to go on and on and on about card printing because I can do this. recap, bridge size, 2 1/4, 3.5. You can get 55 cards on a 20 by 29 sheet or 23 by 29 sheet. Or you can get, realistically, you can get 100 out of a 28 by 40 sheet, just like with poker size. Any other card size, talk to your guy. Okay, talk to your printer, find out what the card size needs to be for your game. Find out what the rows are. If you're not doing exactly the number of cards on a sheet, find out what the row size are. If you're lucky, you can do half sheets of something. Okay, yeah. So if you got 50 cards in a game that gets 100 cards on a sheet, much better than 52, for instance.
I was going to say, this is something I think that's important from the designer's standpoint as well as the people, you know, thinking about manufacturing, because everybody's still restricted to those things. If you're designing a game, look into those parameters, you know.
Can
you afford to fudge losing a card here or there and still retain your game's playability, or can you, you know, expand it by one or two cards, you know, to get that out of there? Because, again, you're probably going to want to spend the money for either a 50 count or a 100 count within the sheet's size.
Yeah.
So the answer there is optimize your design for it.
Yeah. In fact, I've always told people on the websites for the companies I've worked for and my own site was don't wait until your art is done and the design is complete to talk to your printer. Talk to your printer during the design phase as once you've kind of ironed out the game and you have a rough idea of what it's going to be like, talk to him then. He can coach you on your box size. He can coach you on all sorts of stuff. And one of the big ones is optimizing your card cost because, like I said, it's usually the most expensive component in the game.
Yeah, you know, part of the reason is not just the cost of the paper, which is very expensive, relatively speaking, but it's also the cost of the cuts. You know, you have to do a lot of die cutting and everything else, and all those steps are an extra expense.
Yes. All right, so card sizes, paper type, also very important. There's a huge difference between 10-point card stock and playing card stock in terms of price. Pay for what your game needs. If it doesn't need the super duper stuff, don't pay for the super duper stuff. Save yourself a lot of money on getting the game printed. And by the way, in terms of cost, I haven't thrown anything out there specifically. And that's because it as with everything, if you print 5,000, it's a ton cheaper per deck than 1,000. So in all cases, you want to, and the equipment changes, by the way, from 5,000 on up. So you, again, this is another reason to talk to your printer, to let them know where you're going to be cost wise. So, all right, that said, let's move on. By the way, and I'm sure this will generate, for anyone who actually followed that conversation all the way through, this will probably generate at least one or two comments. Please, by all means, if you have any questions about what I said or either what I did or did not say, definitely contact us. We have one piece of listener mail this week, Red. I was very excited about this. This is from Mr. Ned Leffingwell, who wrote in to say, I just listened to the show. I got the Jim Baker joke. Thank you, Ned. Thank you. So, by the way, you spelled Baker wrong. There's actually two K's. But I give him credit for just getting the joke, actually. So
he got the joke.
I'm a very happy man. So that said, Rhett, how can other folks contact us?
Well, you can email us at papermoney@purplepawn.com. You can Skype us at Paper Money Podcast. You can also phone us at 773-634-9377, and we would love to hear from you.
That is correct. And you can call in and leave a message that says, please, God, don't talk about printing ever again. So, anyways.
I'm waiting for the call that comes in and says, can you give us more details on weight?
Yes, exactly. I'll be honest. As long as I worked in the printing industry, I still have yet to find a good way to compare metric stuff to stuff that's measured in points. It literally is almost an apples to oranges comparison. And there's nothing what you almost have to do is when someone says, oh, I've got 450 GSM paper, is to basically put a caliper on it and say, okay, this mics out to, 10.8 point or something like that.
Yeah.
But it does vary. So, yeah, exactly. See, I did it. I did more detail than I was going to.
I knew you were going to.
You suckered me in on that.
It was all an insidious plot on my part.
Yes, to make me look like a printing dweeb. Anyways, upcoming stuff, Rhett. There's not a lot coming up in terms of shows.
No, we still got about a month before we start kicking into the show.
There's some regional stuff going on. In fact, there's a lot of regional shows going on. Small things, for instance, in my one-time hometown of Kalamazoo, Michigan, Marmalade Dog is this weekend at West Michigan University, and I know there's a few local tournaments coming up in the near future here in Florida.
The big show this weekend is out in the UK, and that's Salute, and that's the largest game show that the UK has. It's the one that they all target stuff for.
It's the UK. They're not really into the hobby there.
No, I believe they are the in quotes hobby.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyways, Rhett, why don't you take us out of here?
All right. Well, our next show will be April 30th.
This is why I have you as a co-host.
Are we there?
You still there, Red?
I'm lost. I disappeared there. Sorry.
Yes, exactly. This is why I have you as a co-host.
Yes, yes.
Absolutely fantastic. I believe our next show is going to be the 24th.
The 24th. Probably not. That's Easter. So our next show will probably be the 25th, but calendar-wise, we'll call it the 25th.
Yeah, I'm actually going to be in the air the evening of the most of the day, actually, on Easter Sunday. So, yes, it will be the 25th or 26th before you see the show. During which time we promise we will not talk about printing.
Well, you'll probably be chatting about printing all the way while you're flying.
Or miniatures.
But in any case, yes. So our next show will be April 24th. And that's all for this show.
Thank God. I'm Kim. And I'm Ben Clark.